So if you look here on page one in the packet, you'll see a number of pictures. Just a couple weeks ago, my parents went on a trip to Hungary. And afterwards, of course, they showed me some pictures. And one of the places they went to visit was the Kaczynski Street Synagogue in Budapest. It's constructed in 1912, 1913. You take a look here at the top left picture. This is from the opening ceremony. It's a beautiful synagogue. You look at the top right, this is the way it looks. This is a picture my father took a couple weeks ago. This is the way it looks today. It's an absolutely stunning synagogue in Hungary. You have to understand something about Hungary. In 1944, until 1944, comparatively, and I emphasize the word comparatively, compared to other places that the Nazis had control over, Hungarian Jews were actually doing quite well. Not like Poland, not like other places. And then in March 1944, Hitler really began taking over there. And then in May 1944, the deportations to Auschwitz began. And beforehand, maybe 20,000 Jews were turned over. In 8 weeks, this is May 1944, 424,000 Jews were deported to Auschwitz-Birkenau. And then after October 1944, there were more murders. By the end of the Holocaust, 565,000 Hungarian Jews were murdered. It wasn't a steady, slow progression. In a matter of months, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Jews suddenly were sent to their deaths. And in 1944, if you look here at these images in the middle, the Nazis, Yimach Shemam Zichram, turned this beautiful synagogue into a stable. They kept horses there. Look at the floor, and they desecrated the synagogue. You can see here that they're trying to collect money to restore the synagogue at that time. You see the images of what they did. And then my father showed me one other picture. And it's this picture that I want to use as the launching point for our discussion, for our reading of the keynote today. And we understand when we read keynote, we're not trying to, it's not like putting on tefillin or shaking a lulav. It's not about getting through. It's not just reading the words. It's more than that. That's why we're spending some time introducing. My father showed me the following picture from 1945. And it's this bottom image on page one over here. And it's a picture of Jews sitting in that very same synagogue on Tisha B'Av night, 1945. And I found this picture so moving. So moving. And sometimes when you find something moving, you can't pin down exactly why. I think part of it definitely was, mourning and connotes a certain sense of faith as well. And that's part of it. But what really struck me is that if there's anybody who could understand what a Chorban meant, it was these people sitting on the floor in 1945 who had just seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of their brethren suddenly taken and suddenly killed. And they're sitting there on the floor, remembering a Chorban of a destructed temple, sitting in a place now that they have seen just the images above have been turned into a stable, this beautiful synagogue, to understand what it meant to have a community destroyed. And how poignant that is, and I think that's what struck me. But what also struck me is that that's not our story. Meaning I know in a collective sense, as a nation, this is our story. But I mean quite practically. I don't know, most of you here I know are from one of the three surrounding the towns, areas, Bergenfield, New Milford, and Teaneck. I don't know where everyone grew up. But for many of us, that's not our story, these experiences. And relating to the Chorban is actually very difficult. Relating to what it means to be kicked out of a land, what it means to have a community destroyed. We sit here in this gorgeous Beit Midrash and a beautiful shul. And it's very hard for us to connect. And the question I want to address this morning is, how do we connect? And before we get to that, we have to look at a couple of sources. In the Medrash, page 2 here, it's one of Rabbi J.J. Shachter, Mori Rabbi of J.J. Shachter's favorite Midrashim, describes how Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi, when they were darshaning Psukim about the Chorban, Rabbi Yochanan darish shishin apin, he was able to find 60 different ways to darshan this pasuk from Eicha, Abila, Hashem, Elohama. And Rabbi, it says, who has preceded him, was only able to have a darish estrin v'arba apin, he was only able to darshan it 24 times. And the Medrash basically asks the following question: does that mean that Rabbi Yochanan was greater than Rabbi? Meaning he was able to do it 60 times, so that's so much more impressive. He's greater than Rabbi. And then the Medrash says, no, that's absolutely not the case. Why couldn't Rabbi darshan more than just 24 times? Medrash says, Rabbi Adi Shahaya Samuch L'Chorban Habayis, because Rabbi was closer to the Chorban, Hayad Nizkar, he'd start being Doreshe, expounding it, V'Hayad Doresh Boche, U'misnachim. Meaning it was so close to him, it caused him to cry and to feel the pain, and then he got too emotional to be able to continue thinking about it further. And of course, the closer you are historically, the immediacy of it enables you to cry much more. But that's a difficulty that we feel. And the Rav, and this is from the Psukim in Yirmiyahu, describes quite seriously and emphatically how on Tisha B'Av it's not okay, in Nebuch we can't cry as much, okay, nishtahin, nishtahair, what's the difference? It's actually so much of what Tisha B'Av is about, and when, especially with keynote, is actually crying. In Yirmiyahu, we'll read a short piece from Rabbi J.J. Shachter on page 2 here. In Yirmiyahu, and I put this on the front cover of the packet, in Yirmiyahu, Hashem said, listen, summon the dirge singers, let them come. We need people who know how to teach us how to cry. So that our eyes may run with tears, our pupils fill with water. And the reason why we need professional mourners is because Avelos Chadasha, when someone loses somebody and you and they're mourning, they don't need somebody to teach them how to cry, right? You're ever at a funeral, you don't need someone to teach them how to cry. Avelos Shoshana, when we're thousands of years later, we need the help. We need people to teach us how to cry. But it's important because we do need to feel the loss and the pain. And the Rav, and here we'll move to page 3. The Rav, second paragraph on the left side, says something daunting, and this is what we're going to try to do today. The Rav says that I want you to understand that when I say keynote, it doesn't mean just saying the words. Keynote, like mourning in general, is basically a kiyum shebaleib, an inner fulfillment. It's not just a mechanical reading. Meaning you say the words of keynote, that's not enough. It's an experiencing of the great catastrophe and understanding of what the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash over 1900 years ago has meant to us, to our history ever since. And that's why we have to summon the dirge singers, the professional mourners, and let them come. And that's what on Tisha B'Av we're trying to do, to feel that pain and to mourn and to cry. On the next page, the Rav describes, even though it's difficult to react emotionally, to cry, to be upset, and to mourn for an event so long ago, we have to learn to wail and weep for the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. And to us, the Mikdash must not feel like something just happened 1900 years ago, but we have to be able to relate to it as something that was burned just recently and still burning for us. And when I was reflecting on this and really considering an overwhelming and awesome, not in the contemporary sense awesome, but in the daunting sense awesome, task and opportunity to speak and to present keynote today, I was really struggling with that, which is that how, in the year 2023, am I possibly going to be able to get my beloved congregants, and more, perhaps more importantly, myself, to feel that crying, to be able to sense that connection to what it meant to have the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. And Amishkavi Balelos, I was thinking pretty deeply and trying to think a lot about this. How is it possible to make that connection? And so, I want to make an attempt this morning, though. I want to do something a little different. Hope it works. But I want to try to make an attempt this morning to actually understand what the Churban Beis HaMikdash was like. To have a little taste, a little bit of a sense of it. And I'd like to do that in two different ways. And I'll say personally, you know, this is how I'm connecting this year. I hope it speaks to you as well. And these packets, there's, you know, obviously we're not going to read every line of these packets, but I encourage you to take it home afterwards. And you know, there's a lot of material here that I think you'll find moving and meaningful. So I want to make two attempts. Okay, how we can connect, how we can feel this pain. Because that's the issue that we sit with every single Tisha B'Av. So when I was in my first year at Yeshivat Har Etzion in Gush, one of my madrichim there was trying to get us all to do these different chesed projects. So he told me we were going to, he said, I want you to come with me to this absorption center in Be'er Sheva, where they have Ethiopian immigrants. So I didn't really know much about Ethiopian immigrants, but I liked my madrich. So I went to this place. It was one of the most remarkable experiences I've ever had in my entire life. The second I got there, the Ethiopian children were jumping all over me. They were so excited. You know, they were making, these kids had been in Israel for like 3-4 months, and they were making fun of my Hebrew that I kept confusing Zachar and Nekeva. So when you're in Israel and you're an all-boys yeshiva, you learn how to speak, you know, in Zachar. But I had no idea how to speak, you know, Nekeva to girls. So that was quite an experience. But I went there, and then I had my drift. In the middle of lunch, he announces, and I just want to thank Avraham Wine, he'll be taking over this next year. It's not something I was aware of. So next year, I ended up going 3 more times and leading these trips to the Ethiopian Absorption Center. And that sort of started and triggered my fascination with Ethiopian Jewish history. And I want to share with you a little bit of that this morning, and I'll tell you why. Because it's hard to think about what it meant thousands and thousands of years ago, the Churban Beis HaMikdash. But what about if I told you that there were Jews 30, 40, even a little less than that years ago, who actually were not aware of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, who believed that there was a temple standing, who believed in the holiness of Yerushalayim, and experienced, just a couple decades, you can meet these people, just a couple decades ago, who experienced the loss of the Beis HaMikdash. And just a little background, Ethiopian Jews were disconnected from, there's different theories, 4 or 5 different theories, as to how the Ethiopian Jews got to Ethiopia, and who they are, and what's their background, maybe one of the 10 lost tribes, which they've done. But they were disconnected, they were isolated from the rest of the Jewish people for maybe thousands of years. So they had Sukkot, they had Pesach, they had Shavuos. But they didn't have Hanukkah, they didn't have Purim, they didn't have the Mishnah, they didn't have the Gemara. Because again, they left before that all happened. Of course, they left before Tisha B'Av, at least the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. And there's some really remarkable stories about them. You have to understand that these Jews, so disconnected for so long, were somehow still able to feel a sense of connection to Judaism. I mean, it's not the dominant religion in Ethiopia, you can imagine. And suffered tremendous persecution and kept the faith. I think it's important that everyone actually looks at Ethiopian Jewish history because it's so inspiring and so important. But I want to highlight for you on page 6, which is a sort of famous story. And the Ethiopian Jews really were cut off. And then in the 1860s, a professor by the name of Joseph Halevi went to go visit his people who had heard about these supposed Jews. And he goes and he travels there, and we're on the second column here, and he reaches the first Jewish village. And he tells these people, he says, "I am a Jew," he told the people. And they respond, say, "What, you are a falasha, a white falasha?" Falasha is the, basically means Jew in Ethiopia. He says, you're laughing. I said, "You're joking? You're a Jew?" He said, "You're white. How could you be a Jew?" And he responds to them, he basically convinces the villagers that he too is a Jew. And he said, "I assured them that all the falashas of Jerusalem were white." It says, "The name of Jerusalem, which he had accidentally mentioned, changed as if by magic the attitude of the most incredulous. 'Oh, do you come from Jerusalem, the blessed city?' they queried him. 'Have you beheld with your own eyes Mount Zion, the house of the Lord of Israel, the holy temple?' 'I must confess,' he wrote, 'I was deeply moved on seeing those black faces light up at the memory of our glorious history.'" Now turn with me to page 7. Page 7. And here again we have the same story in a little bit different form. They were laughing at him again that he's white. They say, "Sir, how could you be a Jew? You're white." But then turn to the right column here. It says, during his first encounter, right, he had difficulty convincing them. But when he mentions Yerushalayim, as I said before, their attitude suddenly changes as if by magic. And here it spells it out a little bit for us. The burning curiosity seemed to all at once have seized the whole company. You come from Jerusalem, the blessed city. Have you beheld Mount Zion? Are you acquainted with the burial place of our mother Rachel? They lived thousands of years separated from other Jews. None of them had traveled more than a few miles from their village. Yet they had held on to the prospect of one day returning to Jerusalem. It was an idea that burned in their hearts and had been passed down from generation to generation. This is 30, 40, 50 years ago this continued. You know, many of these Jews walked a treacherous path to Sudan. Thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of Ethiopian Jews, some estimate of 4,000 Jews, walked to Sudan because they thought they'd be airlifted from there to Israel, and they died on the way. And some Jews made it. 1982, there's all these covert missions from Israel to bring back Jews from Ethiopia, and they went through Sudan. Many died through the camps in these camps in Sudan. And they went without ever having stepped foot in Yerushalayim, without having really encountered any other Jews for so long. But they went because of this dream of Yerushalayim, this dream of going back to Zion. And I want to take a look at a few, page 8 for a second. I want to talk a little bit about what it meant to have, what did it mean to have Yerushalayim in your life? The last century, what did it mean to have the notion of a temple, of Zion, of the Beis HaMikdash, of Yerushalayim, Yer HaKodesh? What did that mean? I want to show you two brief pieces about this. It says, and this is written a couple years ago. It says, we Ethiopian Jews simply had no idea that God's holy site on earth was gone. We're on page 8, and we were bereft. We are bereft. He said, until the age of 9, I lived in a world where the Beis HaMikdash, the holy temple in Jerusalem, existed. Like my parents and teachers, I believed that the second temple stood in its place in Yerushalayim and was literally made of pure gold. I grew up hearing about the Kohanim, holy priests, and how they worked in the temple. I fell asleep listening to stories about the halo hovering over Jerusalem, about what the Jews who merited to dwell in the holy city, cloaked in white garments, people blessed with pure hearts, clean thoughts, and devoid of sin. And overhead, I would imagine the Shekhinah, the divine presence of angels. Every single custom they had in Ethiopia was about meriting to return to Jerusalem one day. We prayed and performed customs that expressed our yearning for Zion. We turned our animals' heads towards Jerusalem and we did Shechita on them. Ethiopian halacha is not the halacha that we have, because again, they left before the Mishnah and the Talmud was composed. Everything was about Jerusalem. And they knew that the first temple had been destroyed, but they did not know the second temple had been destroyed. And how strong was our belief in the sanctity of Yerushalayim in our homes in Ethiopia. And this was the concept. This was the concept. When you talk about educational concepts in Bede Yisrael, which is the group of Ethiopian Jews, this was the concept, the core one, the notion of Yerushalayim. The safeguard of our hearts, the purity of our hearts and deeds, in order that one day we'd be worthy of entering Yerushalayim, heaven on earth. Could you imagine growing up with that sentiment? And then they arrive and discover that the temple had been destroyed. But it was the notion of Yerushalayim. It was the notion of Yerushalayim. That's what kept them going. And we'll reflect on what that meant to be destroyed in just a second. I want you to take a look here at page 10. This is actually somebody who works in the in Herzog College, which is adjacent to Gush. It's the same building. So here, Rav Mabaratu Solomon talks about, from my youth in Ethiopia, he was raised on Jerusalem. That this was a word I heard constantly at home in types of all types of situations. Everyday conversations in times of crisis, it was a magical word illuminating and enlightening everyone, filling us with hope that one day this great dream would be realized. Then they travel to Jerusalem, they try to go there, they make preparations, they have this horrible, horrific journey, but they go. Because he says, I remember this journey as the path to realizing the greatest dream of all. Our steps were full of energy as the name of Jerusalem propelled us from within, with the anticipation of seeing the love of your life You are filled with hope and physical strength that is never exhausted. And when they, okay, and then I want to go back with you. So that's what it was like to live with the sense of how central the excitement, the joy, the passion, the notion that this is the peak, what we're striving for, what we're hoping for. But then what happens when they find out? What happens, what does it mean to actually lose the temple, to lose this understanding of, oh, the Yerushalayim, it's not the Yerushalayim of yore? It's two stories. And then we'll move on to the second attempt. If you look at page 5, there's this unbelievable story. It's on ish.com. You see here at the bottom, this is from Operation Moses. Operation Moses, 1984. Operation Joshua, 1985. 1991, Operation Solomon. Anybody know how many Jews they airlifted? 14,000 Jews. Anybody know how long of a span? 36 hours. They packed the planes. That was happened in 1991. But there's some pictures on the bottom here. But this woman, Karen Gottlieb, was teaching Ethiopian Jews. And she said to them, she's talking about Pesach, and she's preparing for Pesach, and says, oh, this is when the Jews used to go visit the temple. And then the students were laughing. What are you talking about? The Jews used to go visit the temple. They were getting upset. She goes, oh, but before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, this is where the Jews used to go. And they thought she was making a joke. They didn't understand it. Okay, she's a little confused by the reaction. She goes back home. She thinks nothing. Okay. She thought the next day she'd go back to teaching math. Next morning, the parents of these children, these Ethiopian children, come to confront her. The student. And she says, what's going on here today? And she said, she sees the student's parents, and they're yelling, they're screaming. And she said, what's going on? And this parent says to them, are you our children's teacher? And she says, yes, what's the matter? She says, our children came home yesterday and told us that their teacher taught them that the temple in Jerusalem no longer exists. Who would tell them such a thing? He looked at me in anger. She says, are you sure the temple was destroyed? And she said that she's a little confused. The temple was destroyed thousands of years ago. This man was incredulous. He said, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? So screaming, furious. And there's uproar. And he says to her, are you sure the temple was destroyed? Are you sure? And she said, yes, I'm sure the temple was destroyed thousands of years ago. And then a different scene commenced. And I want to read this for you. It said, one woman fell to the ground. A second broke down in tears. A man standing by them just stared at me in disbelief. This is what it meant to hear the Chorban Beis HaMikdash. A group of men began quietly talking amongst themselves, very fast in confusion and disbelief. Another woman suddenly broke into heart-rending cry. People were hugging and bawling together. She said she stood there in utter shock, felt she just brought them the worst news possible, as if she brought them the death of a loved one. And these were people genuinely mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And on page 5 here, she says that this, when she reads about on Tisha B'Av, Megillat Eicha, this is what she thinks of. The angry looks of the children, the parents' screams, the mothers crying, the men's pitiful silence, the shock they were overcome with as they received the terrible news. And this, she says, is how we mourn the temple on Tisha B'Av. It's that pain, that visceral pain, the shock, the anger. How could this be? What we spoke about last night prior to Eicha, that closeness we felt with God, the dream, the vision of the Beit HaMikdash, and the connecting with the Shekhinah, that's what it meant to lose the Beit HaMikdash. And that's what Jerusalem meant in people's lives. And if you want to have some sense, a little taste of what it meant to lose the Beit HaMikdash, the story of Ethiopian Jews 30, 40 years ago is one way to connect with that. But I want to make a second attempt. And that is from an event that happened in 2005. Really, 20 years ago, the whole plan started. And that's the story with Gush Katif. And let me be very clear, let me preface this with the following. I'm not interested today in any politics. I'm not interested today in discussing whether it's a wise decision, an unwise decision. It's irrelevant to us at this moment. I want to talk about the emotional experience of Gush Katif. 1970s already, and some of you are more familiar with this or maybe even have been there. We have people in the shul who have cousins from Gush Katif. So 1970s already, Golda Meir, Ariel Sharon was part of this as well, started moving people into the Gaza Strip, different communities, and from sand dunes, without toilets, without any, they built these beautiful communities. It's actually remarkable how stunning they were. And the story of Gush Katif, the greenhouses, many of these communities were actually flourishing communities. And in 2003, Ariel Sharon, who was one of the people who actually helped build these settlements, came up with a disengagement plan. And the plan was to uproot Jews from various areas, not just Gaza, the Gaza Strip, for other settlements as well, but to basically remove them all from the Gaza Strip. Why exactly he did that, we could talk about at a different time. But this was shocking to them. If you look here on page 11, Ariel Sharon said in his campaign that politicians aren't always completely forthright. Ariel Sharon said Nitzarim, which is one of the communities in Gush Katif, is no different than Tel Aviv, and the fate of Nitzarim is the same as the fate of Tel Aviv. Meaning that this is the same way we're never giving up Tel Aviv, we're never giving up the Gaza Strip. So that's not what happened. And over the last 4 or 5 months, I've actually been entranced. I've been gripped by the story of Gush Katif. Watching a lot of documentaries, a whole playlist, reading books. I have some of the books here this morning. And trying to figure out why. I've been talking to people about it. Of course, it's gut-wrenching images. You see the pain. It wasn't just me, 20 years ago. 18 years ago, really, process started 20 years ago, 18 years ago, 2005, they were uprooted in a matter of weeks right after Tisha B'Av. So, what was striking me, what was hitting me so hard about this? And to be honest, I wasn't old enough in 2005 to really appreciate it. I just remember the Israeli Day Parade, people were giving out orange shirts. That's basically the extent of which I remember I'm sure some of you have better recollections of it. Mine is constructed from documentaries and books. But I was trying to think, what's hitting me so hard about this? And I realized that if you want a little taste of what it meant to be exiled from your land, a little sense of what it meant to be sent away from where you believed was your religious future, this is the story. Now you got to understand, take a look here on the top right. This is Nitzarim. It's not one of the biggest yeshuvim. Look at the beautiful place this was. Neve Dekalim, I'll have a picture on the bottom right here, a picture of Neve Dekalim. Neve Dekalim was the biggest settlement in Gush Katif. 2,700 people lived there. There are schools, there are pizza shops, there are supermarkets, there's everything. A full-blown, we're not talking about random caravans strewn out. Significant communities. For decades and decades, people had lived there. Their families died there. 124 people had been killed between 2000 and 2005. And 2005, they were told they were going to be uprooted for it. And the pain of the people is what I believe to some extent, their emotional experience. And of course, it's not the same. It's not the same, the religious upheaval, Jews, they're going to Israel, they're not going to Rome or Bavel. It's a different experience. But I'm trying to, and for a moment, just want to focus on the emotional experience that they felt, however appropriate or not. But it's a lens into what it meant to be exiled from one's land. And you see the pictures here of the tears, the second picture on the left. See the tears, the pain that they experienced. And what was that pain about? I think the pain was this feeling that they were always going to live there. If you ask them where they are from, it's from Gush Katif. They thought, just like the times you really read the stories of the Beis HaMikdash, you read the stories of the... They thought they were staying till the last minute. Many of them thought that this is where we would be. And it was something that was so inconceivable, implausible, impossible to them that they were going to be exiled. It was impossible to them. And there were reasons for that. And beyond that, think about the power of tefillah. I have to tell you, if you want to spend some time watching something today, maybe take a look at some of these documentaries. But there's one in particular. It's called Tefillah HaNa'arot. Tefillah HaBanot or Tefillah HaNa'arot. basically before the the Israeli soldiers came to take everyone out, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of youth, one of the boys in the Sephardic synagogue, the girls in the other synagogue, basically barricaded themselves into the shuls. And the tefillot that they daven there are some of the most moving tefillot I've ever seen. It's gripping. It's painful. These are the images. You see how many women were there crying their hearts out. You have that on the right side. You see the pain of the people on the left screaming out. This girl screaming out, "Fa Abo, how could you do this to us?" Bottom left, how can a person cry? How could it be that you're uprooting a child from their home? Again, put aside the politics. Think about the emotions. And I was thinking that this is a framework for us to think about a little bit to connect to what it meant to have the Chorban, to what it meant to be exiled from one's land. If you look here on page 12, you see images of what it was before and what happened afterwards. I want to connect a little bit with this to some of the feelings that we're supposed to have on Tisha B'Av, and then we're going to begin keynote. Top left is in the Veda Kalim Yeshiva. It's beautiful. It's a synagogue. It's one of the places they barricaded themselves into before they were removed. Take a look at how beautiful it is, top left. Then take a look at the middle of it in its destruction. And then take a look at the top right, where Palestinians were running through shortly afterwards. They were told that they didn't destroy the shuls. They were told that the PA would try to protect the shuls. That did not happen. They were destroyed. They were burned. There were people going to try to take down the lumber to earn a little bit extra money. Imagine seeing that. Imagine seeing your shul looking like that. And imagine here, take a look on the left, on the start on the right. This is Neve de Kalim, before the disengagement. And then on the left here, look at Neve de Kalim afterwards. Those are all houses. And see how they're all gone. This is another settlement here. Rafael Yam, there's a book here, Disengaging Through the Lens. There's a lot of these images. On the left is, and this is what the destruction looked like in these places. And on page 13, I'm just going to quote for you a couple of things. Yeah, people were crying out. They were singing, "Kilo Yitosh Hashem Amo V'Nachal Asol Yazov," that Hashem is not going to forsake his people. He's not going to desert his inheritance. This is the tefillah. And that's not what happened for them. That's not what they felt. When we talk about an Eicha, "Nachal Asenu Nehevchal Ezarim Batenu Le'achem," our heritage has passed to aliens, our homes to strangers. Think about that shul. Think about how in 2023, this is a couple months ago, 2023, Neve de Kalim, this Yeshiva Girls High School, was about to celebrate its 40th birthday. After the disengagement, many of the families from Gush Katif went to a place called Nitzan, and this is where they refounded the girls' school. So in 2023, it's the 40th birthday, right? 22 years in Gush Katif, 18 years afterwards. And they're supposed to have this celebration. And it had to be stopped. You want to know how it had to be stopped? It's because, and how ironic is this, that from their settlements in Gaza, from the ruins of Neve de Kalim and other Yishuvim in Gush Katif, there were rockets, missiles, being shot at Israel. And that's what stopped them from being able to have the 40-year celebration. What irony. And if you want to understand what's Nachlasenu Lepachal Zarim, Batinu Le'Achrim, that's the feeling. If you want to understand Yofi Ad Masenu Le'Zarim, Kochenu Le'Achrim, source number 3, the beauty of our lands is in the hands of Nachrim, the hands of non-Jews. Look at these shuls. And if you want to understand, as we're going to recite momentarily in the first keynote, Shava Suru Meni, our joy ceased. And the Rav talks about so poignantly, about what it means and what it meant for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, is that it wasn't something that happened to the people and the experience. It happened suddenly. The suddenness of destruction. The feeling, oh, I was just standing and now it's gone. That's what the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash felt like. Source number 6 is a book by Stephen Baum, a book not, I don't think, related. I have it somewhere over here. It's actually a book that I strongly dislike, but we'll talk about that afterwards. But basically, he's a Jew, I think from New York, who went to Gush Katif. The title of the book is The Jew Who Went to Gush Katif to Try to Save Gush Katif. That's basically the title of the book. He was not successful. And he goes, and he's part of this whole experience, and all the drama, and all the build-up, and the protests, and so on and so forth. And then he says, all of a sudden it was over. The whole saga seemed so bizarre. Living on Gush Katif's shores one day and waking up in a Jerusalem bed on the next. This is what it means. Shabbos Surman, quick, all of a sudden, immediate. And the idea this is never going to happen. Times the basic mikdash you had in the Nevi'im who are prophets, it's not going to happen. They're not going to happen. One of the main problems and one of the reasons why the destruction happened. Lahavdil. But many religious leaders, amongst them Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu, who very famously, Haya lo nihi lo tihiya. It's not going to happen. I'm telling you, definitively. Chief Rabbi says, definitively it's not going to happen. So you can imagine the many impressionable young religious Zionists there. When the chief rabbi says it's not going to happen, what's not going to happen? This is not going to happen. And so when it does happen, you don't prepare for it, right? You don't pack a piece of clothing because it's not going to happen. And of course, when it does happen, it's absolutely devastating. That's on the bottom left. This young lady puts on a whole play afterwards. How devastating that was to her. But it's this idea. It's impossible. It's implausible. And finally, here on page 15, we have from this book, The Expulsion of Gush Katif. We're talking about, in Gan Eital, one of the Yishuvim. It said on the Saturday night on Tisha B'Av begins, and they're reading Lamentations, reading Eicha. It says, the symbolism is overwhelming. The plaza is filled with young people and old. Mandir is under trees with babies like in days of old. And everyone is struck by the words in chapter 5. Nachlaseinu nebchal zarib. Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers, our homes to aliens. And this is the way we connect to Tisha B'Av this year. To think about what that destruction felt like, to have a little sense. We're not talking about people from 1900, 2000, earlier years ago. We're talking about people from 20 years ago. And can relate a little bit to what it felt like to be exiled from one's land and what it meant to lose the Ethiopian Jews a temple. Hopefully this helps us connect a little bit. And before we begin keynote, though, there's one more question we have to raise, which is that we look at Eretz Yisrael. So I sit there and I say, talk about the temple in ruins and the Yerushalayim. I talk about how, everything's destroyed. The city's empty. We're exiled from our land. Then the problem is, I take a look later today and then I'm going to see the NCSY Kollel Kumsitz, and there's going to be thousands of Jews at the Kotel, and they're going to be singing, and there's Orthodox Jews there, and our land is filled, and the Yeshu Zekinim Zekinos Rehovos Yerushalayim, and I see old people and children sitting in Yerushalayim. And I say nothing later, and I say, how can I say any of this? What does it mean? I'm talking about my land is in exile, people are in exile, land is destroyed. What are we doing here? What are we doing? I think that's the other struggle that we have. And Baruch Shachayanu v'kimanu v'yanu azman hazeh, the state of Israel, I don't downplay the significance and meaning of it for a second. But I want to just point out two things that maybe help, and I'm speaking to myself here, because when I talk about these struggles, I feel them too. Maybe just help a little bit framing this, and then we're going to begin keynote. So there's a story of, in 2007, there were still, as there were many times since then, there were operations going into Gaza, and you had soldiers returning to there. And there's one story, around the time of Shavuot, one of the children who was exiled from Gush Katif, meaning he grew up there, was one of the soldiers who went back, 2007. And Achag HaShavuot, and here on page 16, Achag HaShavuot, they're actually near the shul. They're near the shul in Nisanir, which is one of the settlements. They're near the shul in Nisanir. And you have pictures of this. This is a story told by Sivan Rachav Meir. Okay. And it's Tikkun Leil Shavuot, and they have some time. And so you know what he does? He goes to the shul. And of course, the inside had been desecrated, but the structure was still there. And he goes there, this child exiled from Gush Katif. He goes there, and on Tikkun Leil Shavuot, he sits there and he recites Tikkun Leil Shavuot. And he describes what was that feeling like. And on the top right, he says, in the bottom line, Hatchusha Haita, the feeling was Shel Ben Oved, a lost son, Hamotseid Imo, who finds his mother. And he says, bottom left, by Ragaim Elu, at these moments I felt Har Sinai, I felt what it meant to go back. I felt what it meant to reconnect. And I was thinking about this story. And Lahavdil, I thought it was so profound. And Lahavdil, because we're going to be staying by the Kotel for many, 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 many years. Binyan Olam, we're going to be staying in Yerushalayim. It's not the same. It's not the same. But emotionally, this is how I can connect. Get back to the Kotel. It's so exciting. It's like a child who, anybody who's been to the Kotel, it's like a child who's reconnected with a parent. I brought my children to the Kotel for the first time last year, one of the most emotional experiences I've had in my life. Of course. Baruch Shechayan v'kimanu, the greatest, what a gift, the greatest gift of our times. We have to remember, it's a supporting wall. It's a supporting wall. It's not the base of Mikdash. It's a supporting wall. Yoel ben Nun, Rabbi Yoel ben Nun, when he returned to the Kotel in 1967, you read this in Light Dreamer, he wasn't so excited. It's a supporting wall. So at the same time as we, Baruch Shechayanu, how appreciative, how grateful, how amazing, how incredible it was, we realize it's just a hollowed out structure at this point. We're not back. We're not back at all. And again, with that political commentary, you look at our homeland right now, I don't need to go on a whole explanation for why we're not back to the Beis HaMikdash in the time of Geula. With hundreds of thousands of Jews protesting and hatred and anger, we're not back yet. And we're grateful, but we're not back. And so let us remember these feelings, these emotions, to remember that we have a long way to go as we recite Kino and try to cry and connect. All right, now we're going to start reciting the Kino. The first Kino, I'll give brief introductions. The first Kino is this Kino of Shavasuru Meni.